Open. To whom? Who is there? I wish to enter your heart. Then you want too narrow a space. How is that? Can't I just squeeze in? I promise not to jostle you. I want to tell you marvels. Can it be you, Lady Adventure? How do matters stand with that fine fellow? I mean, noble Parzival, whom with harsh words Kundry drove out to seek the Graal, a quest from which there was no deterring him, despite the weeping of many ladies. He left Arthur the Briton then, but how is he faring now? Take up the tale and tell us whether he has renounced all thought of happiness or covered himself with glory, whether his fame has spread far and wide or has shriveled and shrunk. Recount his achievements in detail. Has he seen Monsalvatia again and gentle Amfortas, whose heart was so fraught with sighs? Please tell us how it would console us whether he has been released from suffering. Let us hear whether Parzival has been there, he who is your lord as much as mine. Enlighten me as to the life he has been leading. How has sweet Herzulida's child, Gamuret's son, been faring? Tell us whether he has won joy or bitter sorrow in his battles. Does he hold to the pursuits of distant goals, or has he been lolling in sloth and idleness? Tell me his whole style of living. Hello and welcome. I'm Douglas Bowles, and this is 42 Minutes, a podcast about meaning from SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's Friday, June 21st, 2024. Happy solstice. And tonight, we really need to ask, what ails thee, dear uncle? That's the question we are questing for on this, our spring installment of the 42 Minutes Seasonal Book Club. We've returned to the Middle Ages to consider what's driving industry, man, the light of the free world. The answer lies deep within Leviathan. Oh, shoot, it looks like I'm conflating intros. Or am I? The Holy Grail in the belly of the whale? Written in the first decade of the 13th century, Parzival is the greatest of the medieval Grail romances. It tells of Parzival's growth from a youthful folly to knighthood at the court of King Arthur and of his quest for the Holy Grail. Exuberant in its telling and profoundly moving, Parzival has inspired and influenced works as diverse as Wagner's Parzival, Terry Gilliam's The Fisher King, and Umberto Eco's Bandolino. Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival is the recreation and completion of the story left unfinished by its initiator, Chrétien de Troyes. It follows Parzival from his boyhood and career as a knight in the court of King Arthur to his ultimate achievement as the king of the Temple of the Grail, which Wolfram describes as a life-giving stone. As a knight serving the German nobility in the imperial Hohenstaufen period, the author was uniquely placed to describe the zest and color of the hero's world with dazzling depictions of courtly luxury, jousting, and adventure. Yet this is not simply a tale of chivalry, but an epic quest for spiritual education, as Parzival must conquer his ignorance and pride and learn humility before he can finally win the Holy Grail. This winged comparison is too swift for unwiped wits. They lack the power to grasp it. Good evening, Zor. Zor. Good evening, Zor.
Zorro.
Are you motley like the magpie?
Partly, yeah. Some parts of me. Yeah.
So, how are you doing tonight?
Good, good, good.
Did you have any idea what you were in for?
Yeah, I did. But I'd never read this before, but I sort of had an idea what it was about through reading Joseph Campbell and other people, but I didn't know fully what it was about, because it's such a great book.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I didn't know where we should start, whether or not we should start. Let's do this a little differently. So everyone has an idea what a Grail quest is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any particular Grail quest that you want to speak to? Like, you know, what is a Grail quest in your mind? And are you on one?
You're just speaking in general. What does...
In general, yeah.
Like in the colloquial sense, like what is a Grail quest now? What does it mean? Yeah, I think it's the quest for higher meaning. Basically, is how I'd put it. You know, it's like I guess I may be influenced by Joseph Campbell and maybe Jung in this way, but it's the quest to really find your own purpose, right? To find what myth you're living and come out to the end of it, right? I read somewhere it's sort of a personal it's a personal teleology or going towards your ultimate end, you know. It's like a in general terms, but I think more in a conversational sense, it just means like just completing your goal, whatever it is, like even if it's a material goal or whatever, like you want to buy a new car or something, and you save money for it, and then you finally get it. That could be a Grail quest, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think of Grail quests linked to a spiritual arena or facet of your life.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'd say so. Like, right now my Grail quest has turned into the Grail. You know, like trying to find out what the Grail actually is, you know. Through this literature. Because like I was saying before, I think it's really the backbone of Western literature, right? There's a line all the way through. These stories go all the way through to the present day. There's no stopping it now, you know.
For listeners who might not be familiar, like this is the MCU before, you know, before there's an, like, this is the whole Marvel universe, but it's not like, you know, 50, 60 years. This is 500 years of development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or more.
Or more. Right. Yeah.
Right. Like if we follow Jesse Weston and that whole school of the mystery origin of the mystery cult origin of the Grail, this goes back thousands of years.
So can you speak to that a little bit? So like the idea of the Grail, but then it somehow connects with what they call the Matter of Britain, which is this body of medieval literature that has a whole cast of characters, you know, that have been worked by a lot of different poets, you know, at various centuries.
Yeah. So, if you break it down like that, that was in, we're kind of dealing with the 12th century here. Like that's sort of the focal point of all these, where all these stories really come to the surface. And that was a century in which that kind of classification of the Matter of Britain and then the Matter of France and then the Matter of Rome were sort of categorized and by a poet, I think he's a British poet as well. And so the matter of France sort of centers around Charlemagne and the first sort of Holy Roman Emperor. Charlemagne was crowned 800 AD, and then that's connected to his knights and squires like Roland and all these other stories. The Chanson de Geste, I think it's called, like all these different stories. And then you have the matter of Rome, and that's concerned with Greek mythology entering into Roman mythology, but especially centered on the Trojan War, like what Homer is dealing with in the Iliad and the Odyssey, but translated afterwards, and then that connects up with Aeneas's voyages to Italy and the discovery of Rome, which Virgil talks about, and then later on that connects to this whole medieval literature on Alexander the Great, which is woven into that, right? So that's the matter of, and all these things are connected, you find out, and then finally the matter of Britain centers around Arthur, right? And you find out from Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which came out early 1100s as well, that King Arthur is a direct descendant of this guy Brute, who came to Britain from Italy, and basically Brute is also a descendant of Aeneas. So there's a full-on continuation of the entire story. From Troy to King Arthur and beyond, you know. So
yeah, I took a class, I think it was in 2005, and it was built around King Arthur. And so we were just looking at the literary references, and there is something in Latin that speaks about a battle captain named Arturus or something like that.
Yeah, that would be Nennius, I guess, is the guy who wrote like 790 something AD. I think that was the first record of this hero. Yeah, this British hero, Briton hero, who fought against the Saxon invaders.
Which is kind of like, some of those thoughts are really interesting to me too. So if we think about this as like, as a myth, you know, like Jesus was, so we think about the other and like his own people and then the people he converts, you know, like who is this hero? You know, who is this hero? So like if he was like native, like a Briton, he wasn't Roman, and the Romans were the power, you know, at the time, but they were also, so it's just interesting to me in thinking about how over time, you know, like culturally they're internalized as something else, you know, so like now we conceive of Jesus as this white guy with, you know, like dishwater blonde hair and blue eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was just something, you know, I guess as a hero becomes appropriated. But, you know, that I'm curious about, you know, like the Welsh people versus, you know, the Anglo-Saxon folks that took over that area and kind of how it all became something else.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the whole Roman occupation of Britain, also, right? Like that, which lasted for about 400 years before they pulled out after Rome fell, and then basically the Britons, sort of the indigenous people of the
right,
were left to their own devices, and they started getting invaded by the Picts and the Scots from the north, which were never conquered by the Romans. And then because of that, the king at that time put out a plea for help to the Saxons, and they came over. The story is these two brothers, Hengist and Horsa, which incidentally Tolkien writes about too. Like Tolkien's on the other side. He's sort of on the Saxon side of this. And so they come over, the Saxons come over. And then that's when, at some point, Arthur comes into play as this kind of general of the British army, of the indigenous British army, right? But even thinking of the influence of Rome on Britain, like 400 years, that's a massive amount of time, right? Like and not all that time was Christian either, right? And so you had all these different Roman cults, like Roman religions and Eastern religions that were incorporated into Rome, right? Mystery religions of all sorts that ended up in Britain. And then there was a big mix there with the original druids and bards and all of those people. You know, it's just a melting pot, the entire thing. It's which is why it's so fascinating to try to unravel all of this.
Something worth thinking about too, though, is how it's not overtly Christian in the sense that there's clergy, there's hermits, but they're not necessarily priests, but somehow it captures the essence of Christianity or the mystery of Christianity.
Yeah, that's probably it, right? That's Weston's take on it, Jesse Weston's take. And just to remind the audience, I guess, or everybody, about Jesse Weston. Her book, Ritual and Romance, appeared on Colonel Kurtz's bedside table in Apocalypse Now, along with Fraser, right, The Golden Bough. So that was a huge influence on the Apocalypse Now. And so even right there, you see how much this whole myth has permeated popular culture, right?
Well, I think didn't that also influence The Wasteland?
Yeah,
like Weston's, yeah.
Yeah, directly. So he, Eliot cites her in the notes to The Wasteland. He cites her, saying this is the book that I used, yeah. But a lot of people started, like, her theory when it came out, like she put out this book in 1920, and she had put out similar ideas before that, but this book really sort of summed it up. It's not that long either. Like I'm reading it again. It's going really quickly, but yeah, she puts out that in 1920, and when it came out, it was really popular and really reputable. Like a lot of scholars sort of went on board with it, including this guy Roger Loomis, who's one of the top Grail scholar, and he was fully on board with her theory of the mystery cult origin of the Grail. And then later on, like in the 60s, he tried to distance himself from her because her ideas got out of favor, I think, because they revealed too much, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, so that is really interesting because Weston has kind of been discredited in the larger literary, I guess, scholarship arena.
Hard to say, though. Like, I'm not sure where the current scholarship stands with her, you know?
Well, so it's fascinating because I shared to the book club group, you know, this essay that appeared in this month's Harper about Yesterday's Men. And it the people that the essay is talking about is Joseph Campbell and Northrop Frye, you know, like, right. And so I think it's the paradigm of literary criticism and with a link to mythology at its core, like mythology being like the building block on some level. And whereas it must have been in the 80s, it kind of shifted to, you know, something different. And then some of this more mythologically based critics somehow became antiquated, which I think this is, you know, this is the nature of life.
Yeah, this is across the board in academia, right? It goes from advancing bold theories about what the text is about, like kind of an exegesis in a way. It goes from that to just textual analysis and looking at different interpretations of things, and not making any claims yourself, like being really cautious. And that goes across the board, like all literary criticism in general is like that. Like even Finnegan's Wake studies, it's now like just looking into like when Joyce wrote certain things within the Wake and how he constructed it and things like that, instead of coming up with like I said, like really kind of bold theories, like Campbell was saying about the Wake originally, right? But I kind of miss it. I think it's the so because of that, it's the role of us, you know, us crackpots here doing right. podcasts to get back to that, you know, because that's where inspiration lies, you know.
Well, so
that's where you're reminding the text come alive again, you know.
And that's a good way to say it, because I distinctly remember Joseph Campbell talking about breaking through the image, you know, like the icon in the church.
Yeah.
Like you have to go through that image to the transcendent source to actually, you know, reach the truth. Like if you're trapped in that image. And so I think maybe that's the same kind of literary criticism that was happening, where that it's not the words on the page or the story, but something that the story is allowing us to be transported through.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
To the shining source.
Right.
And because it's the Grail, it's the life-giving Grail. Do you want to talk about the Grail a little bit, like what it is in this book?
In Percival.
Yeah.
Yeah, Percival. Yeah, we could try to read that part if I could find it. Do you know? Do you remember where it is in the, which book it is? I have it written down. But basically, in this book, unlike in Chrétien, this is why I want to read Chrétien's book as well, or his story. It's a stone in Percival.
Yeah.
And it's it gets. I should read that passage. So if we can find that passage, I should have had it bookmarked. There's one passage where it's Percival talking to Trevrison, I guess.
Oh yeah, and so that's some of my favorite parts is with Percival and Trevrison.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to pronounce these guys, in a French way or a German way. Or
it's like both.
Yeah.
And he's not a priest, but he's definitely like a monk, and he's in the woods alone.
He's like a full-on hermit, and Joseph Campbell compares him to the Buddha's forest teachers, right? Kind of this ascetic teachers that he meets out wandering in the forest, right? And yeah. Percival's first teacher, I'm spacing on names. Gabormans, or what is his name? His first teacher. Anyways, he's the guy.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
He's the guy who, well, he has a cute daughter that he wants to marry off to Percival, but he's also the one that tells Percival not to ask stupid questions. So that his advice gets him into trouble originally, right? So that's his first, Gournemanz.
Gournemanz, that's right.
Yeah.
Because I confuse that name with Gramophlance, which is kind of like the main baddie at the end.
Yeah, Gramophlance is the one who kills Orgulus's husband.
But Parzival's first teacher would be his mother's initial advice.
It's not his mother's advice. Like, his mother's advice was, he had to address everybody.
That's kind of where the adventure began, because she's like saying this, and it reminded me of Hamlet. You know, that speech that was Thelonious gives.
Neither
a lender nor a borrower be.
To your own self be true. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you're saying his mom is his first teacher, basically.
Because she's the one who gives him this advice that he acts upon. And it's interesting because I was speaking to someone on a show using Parzival as one of the metaphors of this, of how she was writing her book. And she was interpreting Parzival, you know, when he stole the ring from the first, is it Segunda? What was her name?
Segun or Segune?
Yeah. Yeah. He stole her ring and really ruined her life, essentially.
Oh no, that's not her. His cousin. She's the one holding her dead dying lover.
Yeah.
The entire book. she's a very interesting character, actually. But no, I know what you mean. The woman that he encounters first.
Jeschut of.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Jeschut. So he steals her ring kisses her because that's what his mother said to do. Or maybe it was a brooch. And then he left. And then the husband's sure that, you know, his wife cheated on him.
Right.
And he treated her thusly for the course of the book until they figured it out. But I don't think, I mean, like, reading between the lines, I don't think he raped her.
No, I think that's pretty clear. And he proves that, or she proves that to her husband afterwards, that he had just...
That he was a galoot, and he needed to be trained, but, you know, he didn't do anything outside of what his mother dictated to him.
He didn't even know the ways of love at all at that point. Like, it wasn't until Kondwiramur's that he finds out about that, right? And even when they first met, they slept together chastely for the first few nights or whatever.
Which version were you reading, or multiple versions, do you think?
I was reading the mustard passage.
And so did it feel, so I've heard that one is the pruder of the bunch. Did you get that sense, or were there sexy parts?
Oh, it's pretty, I thought it was pretty, well, I don't know. My imagination goes off anyways, right? So, but I didn't find it lacking.
Okay. Yeah. Did you find the section on the Grail?
I think it's book 9. Okay. Yeah, I remember that. So what version did you read then?
So I have the A.T. Hato version.
Mm-hmm.
In book form, but then I was doing the audiobook of, I think it's the Edwards translation.
Yeah, I don't know either of those.
And so, like, a good way to tell is just by the intro, you know, because, boy, the intro is so good. You know, if vacillation dwell within the heart, the soul will rue it, shame and honor clash, where the courage of a steadfast man is motley like the magpie.
Hmm.
But, like, all the versions are slightly different with that beginning.
Yeah, yeah. That beginning line really, really sums up a lot of the whole book.
It really does. And so he presents this, the mystery, but also the duality. And so that's why you have to have Gawain in there, too.
Right. And yeah, because Gawain or Gawain, he's sort of the worldly guy, kind of a ladies' man.
Right.
And Campbell is always making the comparison of Bloom and Stephen to Gawain and Parzival. And he claims, I don't know where he finds this, he doesn't make a note of this, but he says there's exactly 16 years. I know there's 16 years between Bloom and Stephen. Like Bloom's 38, Stephen's 22. But he says, Campbell says it's the same, the exact same age span between them. Which is kind of a mind blower, right? So
so Parzival is very young at the beginning of this.
Yeah. Yeah, so he would be I think he would be younger, but the age span between them would be the same. Is his point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, like, one thing you don't really realize until maybe it is Trefresant. When Parzival renounces God,
mm-hmm.
and then he goes out, you know, like, he's just riding the range for 5 years.
Yeah, and it's it turns out that he didn't go outside of like one night's ride or one day's ride of his original finding of the Grail Castle. Like, he's just basically circling the same area for 5 years trying to find it again.
Which is fascinating, because in my mind I associate Grail Quest with the idea of the labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is this circuitous route. It's your own journey to center.
Yes.
Right? And so, like, you could think of the touchstone in the center of the labyrinth as kind of, because it usually is a rock, as the Grail.
Right.
But the whole thing, it's the whole thing that is the Grail. It's like, you know, the quest is the Grail.
That's interesting, too, because at the center of the labyrinth is also the Minotaur, right?
Yes.
It's the monster. It's sort of the dark side of it.
And
that takes us back to House of Leaves. We can connect that up to it.
Well, so there was this time when I was super obsessed with Moby Dick. And
right.
And so that's why I was saying the Holy Grail is in the belly of the whale. Like, you have to go into the monster to find the truth.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, yeah. North of
Fry. But going into the monster, the Leviathan, it's like, it's the world.
Yeah. 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 That's right.
Because Leviathan is the world.
Is the world. And that's what God shows to Job. Takes
him
outside of the world and shows him the Leviathan.
Right.
And then Jonah is in the whale for like 3 days traditionally. This is something Northrop Frye talks about a lot, which is like, so he's a Christ figure as well, right? Like and that's his journey into hell, into the underworld, because that's what happened to Christ after he was after he died on the cross, went to the underworld. And then you have the what is it called, the it's not the scourging of hell, what is that called, the anyways, the harrowing of hell, the harrowing of hell. He goes in there and releases the people who should not be in hell, and then comes back and is resurrected. And then the same with Jonah, he gets spit back out of the whale. All these things sort of tie together, I think.
With the fishing, or the anchor. These kind of nautical Christian things too, Jesus on an anchor, or
Jesus the fisher of men. Yeah.
The fisher of men, right. You're going in,
right.
You know, into the unconscious to pull out the people. Also, the Fisher King, you know, Unfortas is, you know, in the boat guiding Parzival to, you know, the Grail Castle.
Mm-hmm. And then you have Titurel, or Titurel. I don't know how to say his name, but Titurel, you know, do you remember him? He's the old man who's there, the former Grail King.
Right.
Who's not wounded, but he's ancient, right? And there was a whole, like, this sounds fascinating, but there was, in German, in old German, was written this massive poem called The Younger Titurel. I think it's by a poet called Elbrecht or something. And apparently what he's doing, I can't find a translation of it into English. I don't know if there is one. But according to Henri Corbin, in that poem, which came after Wolfram, and this guy is responding to Wolfram in the same way Wolfram is responding to Kretchen. Like Wolfram saying at the end of Parzival, he's saying Kretchen didn't get it all. he messed it up. Yeah, he didn't catch it all. And then this guy's saying the same thing about Wolfram. And he's saying, Elbrecht or whoever, in The Younger Titurel, he's saying that the Grail Castle is actually the Temple of Jerusalem. There's a connection, a direct connection. Corbin is saying this, at least, that there's a direct connection between the Grail Castle and the Temple, right? Which makes the Grail at the absolute center of everything, right? Like if you look at the Jerusalem being at the center of the world and the temple being the center of Jerusalem, it's like the Grail itself is this floating center, right? I would love to be able to read that one.
Mm.
But I found the passage about Trevisant. Should I read this part? Or?
Yeah, read it.
Okay. Parzival did not reveal that he too had once been there, at the Mount of Salvation, right? But asked the hermit to tell him about the Grail. "Well, I know," said his host, "that many brave knights dwell with the Grail at Mount Salvation. Always when they ride out, as they often do, it is to seek adventure. They do so for their sins, these Templars." Another note, "whether their reward be defeat or victory. A valiant host lives there, and I will tell you how they are sustained. They live from a stone of purest kind. If you do not know it, it shall here be named to you. It is called Lapsit Exilis. By the power of that stone, the phoenix burns to ashes, but the ashes give him life again. Thus does the phoenix molt and change in plumage, which afterward is bright and shining as lovely as before. There never was a human so ill, but that if he one day sees the stone, he cannot die within the week that follows. And in looks he will not fade, his appearance will stay the same, be it maid or man, as on the day he saw the stone. The same as when the best years of his life began. And though he should see the stone for 200 years, it will never change, save that his hair might perhaps turn grey. Such power does the stone give a man that flesh and bones are at once made young again. The stone is also called the Grail." And he says, "This day, this very day, there comes to it a message, wherein lies its greatest power. Today is Good Friday, and they await there a dove winging down from heaven. It brings a small white wafer and leaves it on the stone. Then shining white, the dove soars up to heaven again. Always on Good Friday, it brings to the stone what I have just told you. And from the stone derives whatever good fragrances of drink and food there are on earth, like to the perfection of paradise. I mean all things the earth may bear. And further, the stone provides whatever game lives beneath the heavens, whether it flies or runs or swims. Thus, to the knightly brotherhood, does the power of the Grail give sustenance. Hear now how those called to the Grail are made known. On the stone around the edge appear letters inscribed, giving the name and lineage of each one, maid or boy, who is to take this blessed journey. No one needs to rub out the inscription, for once he has read the name, it fades away before his eyes. All those now grown to maturity came there as children. Blessed is the mother who bore the child destined to do service there. Poor and rich alike rejoice if their child is summoned to join this company. They are brought there from many lands. From sinful shame, they are more protected than others and receive good reward in heaven. When life dies for them here, they are given perfection there. Those who took neither side when Lucifer and the Trinity fought, these angels, noble and worthy, were compelled to descend to earth, to this same stone. Yet the stone is always pure. I know not if God forgave them or condemned them still more. If it was his right to do so, he took them back again. Since then, the stone has always been in the care of those God called to this task, and to whom he sent his angel. Sir, this is the nature of the Grail. I've
seen the world. That was 42 minutes. Thank you for sharing it with us. You've been listening to 42 Minute Seasonal Book Club, production of Syncbook Radio and syncbook.com, also part of the CIA. For more information about the Syncbook, our guests, to check out past shows or subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website, thesyncbook.com, and learn about this larger psyop that we've been undergoing for the last 10, 12, 15 years. If you like this podcast, check out others. As currently, all the Syncbook Radio archives are free. We also feature a great search engine on to help you find what you need. Just type in book club and the links appear. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com. Thank you so much. And if it was dumb to please one in particular, she must own I said some agreeable things.